97.9 The Hill, WCHL, and UNC School of Media and Journalism present Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. Sports Focus, dedicated to in-depth examination of issues of overriding importance in the sports world. Each week, we'll discuss problems and look for solutions in professional, collegiate, and amateur sports. From Carroll Hall on the Carolina campus, here's your host, UNC Journalism Professor Charlie Tuggle.
Welcome to Sports Focus. Our topic today, the NCAA penalties against the University of Louisville's men's basketball team and the FBI investigation into college basketball. Our guest, Rick Karcher, who teaches sport regulation, compliance, and other similar topics at the University of Eastern Michigan. He's formerly director of the Florida Coastal School of Law's Center for Law and Sports. Rick, let's start with the Friday morning revelation that several schools in this area, namely Duke, NC State, and the University of North Carolina, are now named in this FBI investigation into what I have called the Adidas scandal. If you will, remind our listeners exactly what that is.
Well, it's in a very short period of time here, I think it's a very complicated case that we are just getting bits and pieces of information about. What we know is there's a DOJ, Department of Justice, investigation into a lot of schools and a lot of activities going on. Underlying all of this would be the issue of, you know, the federal government getting involved in NCAA bylaw violations. So what we have are allegations that people were paid money to get recruits to come to various schools, which has been going on for years and years and years. So that's not surprising that players and recruits are getting paid by various individuals, whether it be coaches or agents or even a company now that might pay an assistant coach. But what's interesting about it all is that you have these underlying NCAA violations, and the NCAA is a private association that can create whatever bylaws it wants to. But this is a precedent, a huge precedent in terms of the federal government getting involved and charging people with crimes who were involved in what resulted in alleged NCAA rules violations. So, you know, it's interesting that are coming out on all this on a frequent basis, but the NCAA will ultimately have to do something, right?
Yeah.
With all of this that comes out of the DOJ.
So when this story first broke, again, what I'm calling the Adidas scandal, because it was Adidas that was mentioned as funneling players to certain schools, paying them money to choose these schools because those schools had contracts with Adidas, right? I've talked to two other attorneys in the past months about this topic. You are an attorney. Both of them said this is big-time prosecutorial overreach. Is that your reaction?
When you say overreach, I mean, I'm very surprised. I mean, it's surprising that the Department of Justice would spend so much in resources on a matter like this. I mean, if you want to dig through the ultimate issue here from a criminal standpoint, what's going on is that recruits are, when they decide to go to a school, they apply through the NCAA Eligibility Center, and they explain, you know, they answer questions about their amateur status. So when they apply through this process, they're essentially lying is sort of the underlying crime here. There's fraud going on. That the way you have to look at this is has nothing to do with athletes, you know, being harmed or any protecting athletes, and these, you know, these poor kids are being exploited. It doesn't have to do with that. It has to do with protecting the institutions from being defrauded by recruits who say, hey, I didn't violate amateurism rules. And it turns out that, you know, later on, maybe, you know, it would be revealed that they did. So the whole crux of the DOJ complaint is that there's fraudulent activity going on. That's one prong, and then another prong. You might look at it from the standpoint of sort of like, an employee at an at a company that commits a fiduciary breach of some sort, right? So an assistant coach is getting paid money that they shouldn't be getting paid according to their employer, who is the university, because the NCAA bylaws prohibit that. So they're getting funneled money that they otherwise, the employer doesn't approve of. So if you want to think of that sort of like a kickback or, some sort of unauthorized, compensation that results in some sort of breach of fiduciary duty, that's the other aspect of this, right? What's last thing I want to say is what's unique is that, typically when an employer is harmed or is damaged by something like this, it has nothing to do with anything. They don't have any control over what's going on as far as a damage standpoint. The way the NCAA rules operate is that essentially they've agreed to penalize themselves because the NCAA bylaws work that way. They've agreed that if one of our people violates amateurism rules, then we agree to penalize ourselves. So if you really think about this, the schools are penalizing themselves when there's an NCAA violation. Nobody else is doing it to them. So that's what makes us sort of unique from the standpoint of the DOJ getting involved and saying, hey, violations of NCAA bylaws are really important things that we should be concerned about.
So. Sports Focus. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now back to the show.
Welcome back to Sports Focus. We're talking with Rick Karcher of Eastern Michigan University about the DOJ, the FBI, Adidas, a number of other things. Rick, let's kind of wrap up the legal side of this because I do want to get more into the NC2A side of it. But the big difference I see as an untrained, I'm not a lawyer, is that with the Adidas thing or the what's been called the underground economy of men's college basketball, there's some legal situations going on here, whereas the other thing about bringing in strippers for recruits and that kind of stuff, that is strictly NC2A. Is that the big difference? One's a legal thing and one is strictly NC2A bylaws?
Well, I think all of the NCAA bylaws, it's a 430-page manual. NCAA bylaws are implicated in all of these issues. As far as the DOJ getting involved, I think that's really unique. As far as the NCAA bylaws and what the NCAA decides to do as a result of their own rules and how they're, the sanctions that they decide to impose and the penalties that they decide to impose, I mean, that goes on irrespective of any legal issues or crimes committed. The Louisville case, is really interesting because, there are a lot of things going on with that. I mean, obviously you have the strippers and prostitutes involved with recruits. So, I mean, prostitution is a crime. And the NCAA doesn't have, subpoena power to require people to speak or to reveal information. So what happened when you get into these cases with the NCAA, they sort of strapped that way in terms of the information and evidence that they can get in a case because it's not a court of law. So Louisville case, I don't know how much you want to go onto that, with the Infraction Appeals Committee decision that just came down as well.
Yeah, let's do jump into that because Rick Pitino, the former coach at Louisville, he was one of the first pieces to fall with the FBI thing. And now the ruling has come out from the NC2A about a different matter. It was the players were being provided prostitutes and strippers. Of course, Patino refers to those as parties. He doesn't mention any of this other stuff. But now Louisville has gotten hit with that and has lost, if the ruling holds up, has lost an NC2A championship because of it.
Right, and revenue associated with the vacating of the wins, as well as all of the revenue that was generated from those tournaments, needs to be, delivered back. So what's interesting about the NCAA case is you talk about Patino, and you read that entire Committee on Infractions ruling, the initial one from June, and then in June of last year, and then the Infractions Appeals Committee's decision. Most of this revolves around the responsibility of a head coach under the NCAA bylaws. So you have some amendments that were made in 2012 to the NCAA rules, which really added a focus of responsibility on the head coach to the extent that the head coach of any program is presumed to be responsible for the actions of all of their assistant coaches and administrators. And that would include grad assistants or, low-level employee. So they are presumed responsible for all of these people who report directly or indirectly to the head coach. So this opens up a big can of worms for institutions in all programs, and it really dovetails in with this DOJ investigation in terms of, how much the head coach should be deemed to know or be responsible for in regards to what their staff is doing, what their assistant coaches are doing. The Louisville ruling demonstrates that they really have an obligation to, according to the ruling, to monitor everything that's going on, take active measures to look for red flags of potential violations, ask questions, communicate with their compliance people, it boils down to communicating, monitoring, and documenting then everything that they do to make sure that their program is in compliance with NCAA rules. So in Patino's case, the NCAA really hit Louisville hard because the way it was stated in the reports was that Patino did not do much of anything to govern what was going on with the recruits and even ask questions to his staff, his grad assistants who were involved in dealing with recruits. They would go to the dorms, they'd be gone. Patino would have no idea, what that basketball operations director was doing with the recruits. And then, would see them the next morning and say, hey, how was your visit? Did you enjoy your stay? And that was the end of it. So, how much, the head coach's responsibility is critical in both, the Louisville issue as well as, the DOJ investigation, as far as I'm concerned, under NCAA bylaws.
Sports Focus. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Sports Focus with Charlie Tuggle. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the Sports Focus and our discussion with Rick Karcher about the FBI, the NC2A, and other related matters. Rick, you mentioned earlier in the discussion about schools policing themselves and that they voluntarily take part or are part of the NC2A. And yet, what's Patino say? They appealed, the NC2A denied the appeal, and now he's saying, let's go to court. So, it's yes, I believe in this self-governance thing until I'm the one getting governed.
Yeah. As far as going to court over, the rulings of the NCAA, that's an extremely difficult battle. I mean, it's almost pointless to do it. I will tell you though that when you look at the infractions appeals process, one thing that has never really been argued before is from a legal standpoint is what is the authority of the infractions appeals committee in regards to its standard of review. In other words, you know, typically in a court of law, when you appeal a ruling, a lower court ruling, you know, there's the appeals court will look at what the lower court did and see if the lower court, you know, followed precedent, or whether there are, you know, the penalties were out of line in terms of, you know, what happened in prior cases with similar facts. The infractions appeals process, it does not follow the same format. In fact, there's nothing in the NCAA bylaws that really lays out what the standard of review is when the appeals committee reviews the Committee on Infractions ruling. There's a 1995 case involving the University of Mississippi that the Infractions Appeals Committee always cites to. And in that decision, the appeals committee actually created its own standard of review, a standard of review that's not even in the NCAA bylaws. Now, this is a technical issue, but, you know, one could argue that the Infractions Appeals Committee doesn't have the authority to create new rules and standards. The member institutions are the only ones that can create rules and standards. So you have this Alabama State, I'm sorry, I said Mississippi, University of Mississippi. That actually goes back previous to that, to prior to 1995, an Alabama State University case where they outlined the standards for abuse of discretion, and it's almost impossible to overcome that for anybody to meet that standard, any institution. It's got to be, just leave it at that. There are five factors that need to be shown, and you know, it's near impossible for any institution to overcome that standard. And so, you know, you have these situations where Louisville appealed, and it even reminds me of when USC appealed, you know, the infractions appeal, or the Committee on Infractions ruling with the Reggie Bush matter. You know, they argued the same thing. It was an abuse of discretion. The penalties were excessive, abuse of discretion. And it's almost impossible to overcome, and it's basically rubber stamp, you know, rubber stamp by the Infractions Appeals Committee. And both institutions are arguing the same things all the time. Hey, this isn't in line with precedent. We don't, you know, the penalties that were imposed are way beyond what the facts tend to suggest. And the appeals committee says, well, we don't really have to follow precedent. And, you know, precedent is a guide, but it's not controlling. And so you lose.
Yeah. So. Well, Rick, we have about 2 minutes left, and I want to make sure we get in this last question. And it is, Patino has said it's unjust that you would take away a title. Our kids earned it. You know, having these parties, as he called them, didn't do anything to make us better players, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the other part of it is, which surfaced immediately, is how can you hit Louisville as hard as you're hitting them and you let UNC off the hook? What's the difference between those two cases?
I don't work for the NCAA, and I wasn't involved in the committee ruling. So my opinion is that it really doesn't matter, and it's sort of strange to say that, but I mean, they're going to rule whatever they want to rule based upon, you know, whatever they decide. It's very subjective, is what I'm saying. And if you don't have a whole lot of precedent, you know, that's actually controlling. In fact, if precedent isn't controlling, you know, it's kind of an exercise in futility to be arguing whether one is, you know, unfair or unjust. The only thing I can think of the distinctions are, you know, academic issues versus recruiting issues. You know, Louisville, you had the recruiting issues and what was labeled as impermissible benefits that recruits had received at Louisville, versus an academic, you know, academic fraud type issue. They're two totally separate situations. So maybe that's the only way you can look at it.
All right. So we have about 30 seconds left. Very quickly, is it an impermissible benefit to provide hookers, if you will, to recruits? I think we all know the answer to that, but what is the answer?
The answer is whatever the NCAA says. So the NCAA said it was. So the answer is yes.
Short and sweet. Right. Right. And that does it for this edition of Sports Focus. Thanks to our guest, Rick Karcher, Thanks also to engineer Gary Kirk. And as always, thanks to you for listening. Cheers.
Thanks to Richard Southall, Mark Nagel, and Deborah Southall at the College Sport Research Institute at the University of South Carolina for their research and guidance and for access to CSRI's international network of sources. Sports Focus is a service of UNC School of Media and Journalism.